Welcome to Off the Chart with Medical Economics, a podcast featuring lively and informative conversations with healthcare experts, opinion leaders, and practicing physicians about the challenges facing doctors in medical practices today. I'm Jeff Bendix, Senior Editor of Medical Economics.
The 21st Century Cures Act, which Congress passed in 2016, included a provision to make it easier for individuals to obtain access to their personal health information. In April of this year, the rule implementing that provision, known as the Information Blocking Rule, took effect. My guest today will discuss progress in complying with the Information Blocking Rule. She is Devin McGraw, co-founder and chief regulatory officer of Citizen, an organization formed to help people gain access to their health data. Before founding Citizen, Devin was Deputy Director of Health Information for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Thanks for joining us today, Devin.
Thanks for having me, Jeffrey.
Start by reviewing for us what the Information Blocking Rule says exactly. I know that's a pretty broad question.
It's a little bit of a tall order.
Yeah, summarize as best you can.
Essentially, what it says is that if you're covered by the rule and you get a request for electronic health information, and by law, you are permitted to share that information, the law basically says you need to share that information unless you have a very good reason for not sharing it. I'm obviously putting this in layperson's terms.
Of course.
And in particular, the government has identified sort of seven good excuses for not sharing, and it's generally sort of intended to make sure that people are still engaging in good practices with data, like protecting it from a privacy and security standpoint. There's also an infeasibility exception where, you know, let's say you're a very small organization and you get a request for a lot of electronic health information and you can't necessarily meet that request for various reasons. You know, there are still reasons to be able to say no, but essentially, I think what Congress was doing when it passed the 21st Century Cures Act, which is where the information blocking provisions came from, was to say, we want to make sure that anti-competitive concerns, proprietary concerns, other issues that have gotten in the way of data sharing in the past can no longer be good excuses for not sharing. There still might be really legitimate excuses for not sharing, but in general, the expectation is if you legally are permitted to share this electronic health information, then you need to share it.
So I would presume that would cover all the major hospital systems in the country and the VA and organizations like those?
Yes, absolutely. So healthcare providers are covered by the information blocking rules, as are certified electronic health information vendors.
Yes.
And then an entity called a health information exchange, mm-hmm, or a network, which is, you know, these exist in states across the country. Some states have more than one, generally been stood up in order to allow healthcare providers to exchange data with one another, or health plans to be able to access data. But I think the idea is these networks, these exchanges, could be tapped for a number of other data needs, and they need to consider those requests.
It's been 5 years since the Cures Act was enacted. Is it normal for a rule to take that long to get written, or is there something unusual about this one?
I do think that this feels to me like it's been slower than normal. Recognizing that changing putting a rule out there that basically favors information sharing as opposed to being kind of allowing information sharing, but giving a lot of discretion to entities about whether they shared and when they shared and with whom and how much. It's a sea change. It's a big deal. And I think it's a big adjustment for entities. And they are still, notwithstanding the amount of time that's passed since the Cures Act first was promulgated or the first enacted by Congress, and then you have the regulations that came out, people are still saying they need more time.
Why do we even need this in the first place? It seemed like such a no-brainer that people should have access to their own health data.
Well, absolutely. But I think we have hardwired into providers the protectionist mindset more so than the sharing mindset. The ways that people get blocked from their data is not just by being told no, but by the scaffolding and the amount of work that it takes to get that data in the first place. You know, things like making patients come in person to get their health records, requiring signatures on authorization forms or consent forms to be notarized. Like just lots and lots of little steps that people were required to take in order to get access to their data. And sometimes, yes, sometimes people were told, no, you don't have the right to get this data, which was wrong under the law. But nevertheless, we have trained entities really well in the post-HIPAA world to be protectionist around data. And in addition, data is an asset of an organization. And so they're really reluctant to share it unless they're absolutely sure that the person on the other end has a right to the data. The person on the other hand is the person who has the right to the data and is not going to take the data and do something with it that's going to harm the data holder. You know, there are all sorts of, data as a corporate asset and data as something that should be protected has been the mindset of healthcare entities that are covered by these information blocking rules for some period of time. So reversing that to sort of turning these entities into sort of, oh, my obligation is to share. I need to do so in a way that is protected, but I can't, you know, but at the end of the day, I have to be more open to sharing than I have been in the past. That's why it's such a big deal.
And organizations saw this as an asset, as a way of keeping patients within their system or within their practice.
I think that is a mindset that's out there. I think it's not one that makes a whole lot of sense to me because generally the statistics show that when patients do have access to their data, they're much more engaged in their care. They feel they're likely actually to feel a greater attachment to the organization that is open with them and that is sort of welcoming them as more of a partner in their care instead of just, you know, this person that things are done to, right? It's this much more sort of open, transparent, kind of bi-directional relationship aspect to it. But yet it is the case, if I have my data and I'm not happy for some reason with the care that I've received, I'm much better able to go seek care elsewhere in a very seamless way.
Give our audience a little background about Citizen and why it was formed and what it's designed to do.
Sure. We founded Citizen in honor of our founder's sister who died of metastatic breast cancer. And what he saw when he was taking care of her as someone who did not have a very good prognosis, she did not survive, but obviously they wanted to do everything they could for her, get her the best possible treatment, find out if she was eligible for clinical trials, and even to be able to sort of contribute to research, because again, for any person diagnosed with metastatic cancer, your prospects are not good. And we need to understand more about cancer, both in terms of prevention and treatment. So there's, you know, cancer patients are also very interested in kind of saving their own lives, but saving the lives of people like them. And that's an important aspect. But when you can't do any of those things, it's a lot harder to do any of those things. Seek a second opinion, find out about clinical trials if you don't have data. And it was hard for him to gather all of his sister's data. It took a lot of work. He first, you know, went into her portals, but found that it didn't have very much information in it. But when he went to the health information management departments to get data, he got pages and pages and pages of information. But it was also, you know, not very well organized in terms of getting her to care. So we really wanted to build a tool that a person with an illness could use to, again, seek the best possible treatment options for themselves, but then also be able to pay that data forward in a research context, but all under their control and with their decision-making and something that would be free. So that was really the reason why we created Citizen. And we have, you know, 22,000, I think, give or take a few hundred patients on our platform now. Most of them have cancer. And we also are serving some families with mostly children with rare neurological conditions for many of them, there's very few treatments. There's very minimal understanding about the course of disease. So those patient populations are very interested in empowering research, to understand more about the disease and for a cure. So it's really about not the patient's not waiting for the healthcare system to respond to their needs, but to sort of be able to take their own actions, be able to take their own steps, have themselves and their families be more empowered with data so that they can seek out what might be best for them. But really the ability to collect all of a patient's information and then be able to organize it so that it's actually useful is kind of key to the whole equation.
Do you help patients who encounter roadblocks in obtaining their information?
Absolutely. I mean, we found that for most patients, especially when they're sick, and, you know, the work that it takes to amass your entire medical record can really be quite time consuming. Lots of phone calls, lots of time on hold, you know, negotiation about the format that they're, you know, can you get it by email? Do you have to get it on a disk? If you get copies of your images, how are you going to upload those? Like lots and lots of different questions that come up. So we decided really early on that we were going to need to do that for our patient users in order to make the platform valuable to them. So we actually have a staff of people who do the work to get your medical records for you. You know, it's at some point where federal policy is going to allow you to hire a service like Citizen to plug directly in to those APIs that are being offered through the electronic medical record systems that doctors and hospitals use. But that's still a work in progress. And it'll take some time, I think, before the entirety of the medical records that you have a right to. Till that happens, you know, there's still going to be some of this back and forth with medical records offices when what you need is your full complement of records, as opposed to, oh, I had a lab test done and I just want to check and see what the result was.
I suppose part of the problem is just that our information is so dispersed. It's often not in one location, right? Our doctor's office might be different than the hospital where we're admitted in, which might be different from the labs where we got our tests, things like that. Is that correct?
No, that's true. And frankly, the sicker you are, the more likely it is that your information is dispersed across, you know, lots of different systems. But even if you have your care at sort of one facility or within one system, like I was a Kaiser patient for years. And so I didn't see a doctor that wasn't a Kaiser doctor. But even then, not all the information that was generated as part of any particular encounter that I had at Kaiser was in my portal. But when you get sicker, and all of us will at some point have illness challenges, even those of us that are healthy and need to see doctors in multiple places, and in addition, have information that is portable and not just static in the doctor's office at their portal where, oh, I can see it and I can access it, but what happens if I change insurance? What happens if I change doctors? What happens if I move? The portability around current portals is not where it should be in order to sort of, again, make that data really owned by the patient in a way that the patient can take it where she needs to go. So that was the sort of the vision of Citizen, is that you're not beholden to any particular provider, that you have the ability to, you know, seek care wherever is best for you. You might decide never to seek, you know, to stay exactly where you are. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the other advantage to getting a copy of your information is that doctors are not required to keep your records forever. So if you had an illness, say, in your early 20s, by the time you're in your 30s and 40s, does that data still exist? It very well may not anymore. You don't have a copy of your records from when you were a child, especially if you had a serious illness when you were a child. Something happens later in life. Can you get a hold of those pediatric records to see whether there was something that sort of had its start when you were young, or might be a reaction to a treatment that you received as a child? You may not be able to get those records if you don't get them now. We just haven't oriented our medical record keeping system in this country around the patient. We've oriented it around the healthcare provider. At Citizen, we're not trying to upset that balance. Medical records have to be kept by providers by law, but we think that patients should have their own records too.
What do you find is common reasons for lack of compliance with the information blocking rule?
Some of it is just lack of knowledge that these rules even exist, notwithstanding that, as you and I spoke earlier, they've been around for quite, you know, they've been in effect since April. We're, you know, closing in on a full year. They, even before that, the rule that had been proposed was 2 years before that. Even before that, the Cures Act, again, several years old. So the lack of knowledge that these rules exist and that they do apply to various actors is still shocking to me. But then even if folks have a notion that they exist, there are lots of questions still about the details. You know, the interesting thing about the information blocking rules is that they're what are called fact, it's based on the circumstances, right? Did you block information is really a question of like, well, what was the nature of the request for data? Why did you not provide that data? Or if you did provide the data, but not in the format that the person wanted, what was the reason why you didn't do that? And there's an intent element to violating the information blocking rules. You have to, in the case of a healthcare provider, you have to know that you're information blocking when you're putting something into effect that creates an obstacle to information sharing, or you're failing to do something. And then if you're a health information exchange, or you are a certified electronic medical record vendor, you have to know, or you should have known, that what you were doing. So slightly less lower standard from a legal standpoint, but that intent really needs to be there. But what constitutes intent? If you sort of put something into place and you never evaluate what its impact is in terms of access to data for patients, did you know you were information blocking at the time? So there's a lot of uncertainty around, you know, what types of activities that are kind of normal behaviors for entities when they release data, even to patients. Which of those activities would now be considered to be information blocking? So the government is, the federal agencies are trying to put, and in particular, the Office of the National Coordinator for HHS is trying to put out guidance in response to questions. But, you know, I participate in a lot of working industry working groups around these information blocking rules. And the number of questions that have come up, I mean, it's not insignificant. There will be a lot of time that we'll need to, you know, as we get to the point of enforcing this rule, when we do that, we're going to need to do so in a way that continues to educate the public and entities that are regulated by this rule about what types of behaviors constitute blocking and which ones don't, because I think there's still a lot of uncertainty out there.
Who's responsible for enforcing it?
Well, it depends on which actor you're talking about. So the Office of the National Coordinator for Health IT has investigative powers, and they also have the regulatory power to set the rules about what's not information blocking. So those are the so-called information blocking rules that we've been talking about. And ONC used some of that authority also in conjunction with its authority to regulate electronic medical records to set certification standards for electronic medical records. But when it comes to actually levying penalties, that's done by the Office of the Inspector General in the case of a health information exchange or a certified electronic medical record vendor that may be information blocking. And then providers are referred to CMS for payment disincentives. And at least with respect to OIG, we had a proposed enforcement rule that came out more than a year ago, but has not yet been finalized.
OIG is the Office of the Inspector General.
Yes, the Office of the Inspector General at HHS. Mm-hmm. They have the penalty authority up to $1 million per incident. They established a regulation, which was mostly what we call in legal terms, a process rule. Like, it was just about what are the processes that will take place and what kinds of priorities will we have for, for seeking penalties. Again, that rule has not yet been finalized. And then for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, you know, there are supposed to be payment rules around what's going to happen to you if you're found to be information blocking, but we've seen nothing proposed from CMS yet. You know, I have seen legal arguments been made, not in any official context, but sort of more on a, you know, well, what's going to happen if a provider's information blocking now, as when we don't have any particular rules in place around what the payment disincentives would be. You're arguably it's False Claims Act problem. If you have submitted information in order to be paid by the federal government as a condition of being paid by the federal government that said you weren't doing something, then and it turns out that you were. That could be problematic, but that's a heavy hammer for CMS to pursue.
Yes.
And I can't imagine that would be done outside of some pretty egregious circumstances.
Going back to Citizen and Self for a minute, how does the platform gather the information it uses to rank institutions on their compliance with the information blocking rule?
Right now we're mostly adjudicating compliance with the HIPAA right of access.
Okay.
But frankly, if you're violating the HIPAA right of access, the chances are there's evidence in place that you're also blocking information, depending on the nature of your failure to comply with the privacy rules. When we first started gathering records for patients, I came from the regulated agency. I knew what they were supposed to do. And I was surprised just how often, you know, records were not provided in a way that was compliant with the rule. They were not provided within 30 days. They were not, there were attempts to charge us a lot of money for records for patients well beyond what HIPAA allows. So we decided to create a scorecard and rate on a scale of 1 to 5, just how well records were provided in response to a patient request. And we create this scorecard. It is just based on our experience of gathering records. So it started with a really small number on the scorecard. I think there were 75. At some point, I remember these numbers. We've been doing this for a couple of years now, and we have more than 4,000 healthcare entities on the scorecard now. But it is based on, you know, how well a request from a citizen user gets responded to. Now we process those, so we know exactly sort of how long it took, how many phone calls it took, how much was charged, things of that nature. So we're able to serve as a very authoritative source on that information. I will tell you though, when we first rolled out the scorecard, we did a survey. We also did a phone survey where we asked questions about what are your processes for getting records to patients, took note of the responses and we had close to 3,000, I think, providers on that survey at a time when the scorecard itself had less than 100. But the results were remarkably the same in terms of more than 50% of providers being out of compliance with the right of access. Same thing on the scorecard. Now, the longer that we've kept the scorecard, there's been like huge improvements. Like now the percentage of providers that are out of compliance is actually pretty low. It's lower than a quarter.
That's encouraging.
Yeah, which I can't take full credit for it that the scorecard did all of this, because at the same time we launched the scorecard, the HHS Office for Civil Rights, which enforces HIPAA, my former colleagues, they started more robustly enforcing their right of access with penalties, most of the monetary settlements. They've had 19 in the last couple of years, 19 settlements in the right of access, and they more seem to be coming. This doesn't seem to be something that they're letting up on in the new administration, which I think is probably the bigger reason why stuff got cleaned up in certain places. But it's been really interesting to see the impact of publicly reporting on an experience of getting records and how much that can help to make sure that those processes are in compliance with the law. So we are actively thinking actually about how we upgrade that for information blocking. It's just a little bit trickier because, again, that information blocking rule is a bit more nebulous in terms of its expectations.
Where does Citizen get its financial backing?
So up until very recently, we were funded by venture capital firms. But a couple of months ago, we were acquired by the genomic medicine company Invitae.
For medical care providers, in particular primary care providers who are our audience, how do they benefit from patients having access to their health data?
Well, I mean, you know, I think the way that they benefit is by the patients coming into them and being more informed mm-hmm. about their care. And after a visit, having access to the notes and the information that occurred during the visit, more likely for them to remember, more likely for them to share it with a family member who can help them remember in the case of someone who is sick or someone who's elderly, a greater ability to sort of be informed. I don't know if you know anything about the Open Notes program. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they've done a lot of research on what the impact is on the ability for patients to access the notes that were taken during, you know, a clinician visit. And generally what they have found is that the overwhelming evidence is that patients are better informed, more engaged, appreciate having the information and being able to interact with their physician at a much different level in terms of just having that knowledge base and a greater understanding or an ability to understand what's happening with their illness or with their care. So overwhelmingly, the gut reactions, for physicians who are less familiar with sharing this information with patients can be quite negative. But again, once, you know, folks who have studied this show that in fact the opposite is true, that it actually improves relationships. So I think obviously there's an area that is ripe for additional research. Does it actually result in better outcomes for people? Because they're more engaged, they're more likely to do the things that their doctors told them to do because they can get reminded of it through an app that they have, which has the information, and maybe they can feed it into a tool that gives them reminders to take their medications and things of that nature. You know, there's a lot that happens outside of the physician office. There's a lot that happens outside of the hospital where it's really going to be the patient and the patient's family members or friends that are going to make those care recommendations actually happen. And when the patient has that information too, it's a no-brainer that they're much more likely to be able to act on those things in a consistent way.
Is there anything else that doctors need to know about the information blocking rule?
Yeah, I think if you're hearing about this information blocking rule for the first time, you definitely should take a look at it. If you're in a small practice, obviously, I think probably your professional society will have some information for you about it. In general, I think what it means is when you get a request for information, especially when it's coming from the patient, the expectation is that you provide it. And then it's really in how are you going to do it? What kinds of tools do you have at your disposal in terms of getting information to your patients? Has your EMR been upgraded to the most recent APIs so that your patients can get more information through their portals so they're not bugging your staff? You know, there are lots of ways that this could be a very positive development. So that's what I would say is it's more opportunity. It should be more opportunity than pain. I think what I'm hearing mostly from the medical community is just a lot of pain. And I think that's inevitable with new regulations, but I think if you go at it with an attitude of this can be a net positive, especially with respect to sharing information with my patients, I think you will find that it is, again, more positive than negative.
Well, Devin McGraw, thank you very much. This has been very helpful.
Thank you, Jeffrey. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks for listening. You can subscribe to our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. And when you do, please leave a review. You can find previous podcast episodes on our website, medicaleconomics.com, under the Media tab. We welcome your comments and suggestions for future podcast topics. You can email these to us at medec@mjhlifesciences.com. And while visiting our website, be sure to check out the latest news about the business of healthcare and explore the many other resources you'll find there. We hope you'll listen next month for a new episode of Off the Chart with Medical Economics.